Thank you for traveling with Amex Platinum. To your right, you'll see Oceanside Relaxation at a fine hotel and resort property. When booked through Amex Travel, you can enjoy complimentary breakfast for 2 and 4 p.m. late checkout. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Gene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lessons from the world's top professors, anytime, any place. World history examined and science explained. This is One Day University. Welcome. And we're back on the untold history of sports in America. I'm your host, Mike Coscarelli. Sad to tell you, folks, this is our last episode, so soak it in. I'm going to miss bringing you history every week, and I hope you'll miss hearing my sultry tones in your headphones. We got a special thing going, you and I, but part of the journey, of course, is the end. Today, on our final episode, we'll be discussing players in the modern era of sports and their obligations to their social conscience. Whether or not a social conscience has a place in sports is seemingly always up for debate, but let's hear what Matt thinks about it.
Last time we traced the links between sports and patriotism and militarism, and I ended with the story of Pat Tillman, a man celebrated for his athleticism and his military service, you know, the strong, silent American who answered the call of duty both on and off the field. Today, we explore a group of athletes that some Americans consider the opposite of Pat Tillman. Today is the story of athletes who use sporting arenas for political protest to critique the United States. Now, some people consider protest to be the height of patriotism. Others consider it to be the exact opposite. It's un-American, especially when during the playing of the national anthem. As a nation, we seem pretty divided over this. Well, the most prominent and controversial of these protesting athletes was the San Francisco 49ers quarterback, Colin Kaepernick, who started taking a knee, as they called it, in NFL stadiums as a way to protest racism and police violence. This lecture pivots around Kaepernick. I want to tell you what he did and why he did it. Maybe you agree with it, maybe you don't. But I want to give you both the backstory and talk about what has happened after Kaepernick. So let's start with that larger backstory. I'm going to go back a little bit. You know, last time when we were discussing rebellious American athletes, I suppose it was when we explored Muhammad Ali and Tommy Smith and John Carlos in the 1960s, using their platform as athletes to illuminate their grievances about race. And then, of course, we discussed Billie Jean King and the way she used her tennis stardom to critique sexism in sports and the wider American society. Now, I'm painting in very broad strokes here, but broadly speaking, that spirit of athlete activism, it went away in the late 70s and 1980s. As athletes were starting to make more money, they were learning to be silent and protect their brand. This was an idea we talked about with Michael Jordan. But in the early 1990s, there was an interesting moment involving one of Michael Jordan's teammates on the Chicago Bulls. And it's a moment that I'm going to use because it reminds us that the activist spirit was not entirely dead, but it also illuminates the cost of that activism. Craig Hodges was a shooting guard on the Chicago Bulls in the 80s and the early 1990s. He was an outstanding three-point shooter. And he was a key member of those early Michael Jordan-led Bulls teams that won three consecutive NBA titles in the early 1990s. Craig Hodges was from Chicago, He had grown up amid poverty in Chicago. He had witnessed violence by police officers against Black Americans in Chicago. And in 1991, he wanted to speak out against this poverty and this violence by using basketball. The 1991 NBA Finals matched Michael Jordan's Chicago Bulls and Magic Johnson's Los Angeles Lakers. And game one was in Chicago. And the day before the game, Hodges met with both Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson, and he suggested that they all boycott the game. This game was being played just a few months after Rodney King had been beaten by four policemen in Los Angeles. In March of 1991, a video captured four white police officers beating a Black motorist, Rodney King. King ended up in the hospital with a fractured orbital bone, a broken ankle, numerous lacerations. This was a new phenomenon in American history. That is, a video showing what Black Americans had been saying for decades. We are the victims of police brutality. Well, the NBA Finals were 3 months after this. Game one was being played in a state, Illinois, in which 32% of the Black population live below the poverty line. No one is taking these issues seriously, Craig Hodges told Magic and Michael. So let's illuminate these problems and start a dialogue by boycotting game one. Now, according to Craig Hodges, Michael Jordan told him that he was crazy. Magic Johnson was a little more receptive, but told Hodges it's too extreme. Nothing happened, and the game and series was played. The Bulls won. But Craig Hodges regretted his inaction. He felt as if his generation was more concerned with economic gain than creating a unified movement and speaking out against injustice. So the next year, he decided to act. The next year, after the Chicago Bulls won the NBA title again in 1992, the team visited George H.W. Bush at the White House. And Craig Hodges stood out that day wearing an agbada, a West African garb that became semi-popular in the United States during the Black Power era. Wearing an agbada or a dashiki was a statement of Pan-African identity and pride. So Craig Hodges was there at the White House and he shot a few jumpers with the president. The newspapers tell me that wearing that agbada, he was 9 for 9. And then as he and his teammates left the White House, he gave President Bush a handwritten letter. And here's how that letter began. The purpose of this note is to speak on behalf of the poor people, Native Americans, homeless, and most specifically, the African Americans who are not able to come to this great edifice and meet the leader of the nation where they live. This letter is not begging for anything, but 300 years of free slave labor has left the African American community destroyed. It is time for a comprehensive plan for change. Hopefully, this letter will help become a boost in the unification of inner city youth, and these issues will be brought to the forefront of the domestic agenda. So Craig Hodges was using this visit as a celebrated basketball player to urge the president toward action, to do something to save what he called later in this letter an endangered species, young Black men in the inner city. I actually, just reading it now, don't think it's a particularly controversial or antagonistic letter, but the Chicago Bulls were embarrassed by Craig Hodges. They were embarrassed by what he wore that day and by him giving the president that letter. His contract was up and the Bulls did not re-sign him. And even though Craig Hodges was the best three-point shooter in the NBA, no team signed him. Craig Hodges never played in the NBA again. There were severe consequences for his actions. Well, this was more or less how it went for the next couple of decades. I'm not saying no athlete ever spoke up about any issue. Some did. The basketball player Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, the collegiate basketball player Tony Smith, he and she, they used the national anthem to make statements of opposition against the American war in Iraq. But a tipping point clearly came in 2012. In February of 2012, a 17-year-old named Trayvon Martin was walking back to a home he was visiting in a neighborhood in Sanford, Florida. And a resident of this neighborhood, George Zimmerman, he saw Trayvon Martin walking, and he immediately called the police and reported that a black man in a hoodie was walking through his neighborhood. George Zimmerman told the police dispatcher that he assumed Trayvon Martin was a criminal. Zimmerman got out of his car and confronted Trayvon Martin. And exactly what happened next is in dispute. But what we know for certain is that George Zimmerman had a gun. Trayvon Martin did not. And George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon Martin. In response, the NBA star LeBron James and other members of the Miami Heat, they took to Instagram and they posed in their hoodies, heads bowed in remembrance of Trayvon Martin. This was a statement that being black and wearing a hoodie should not be considered a crime. It should not mark you as a criminal and get you killed. Then came Ferguson. Michael Brown was an unarmed black man who was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri in August of 2014. Witnesses said that Brown had put up his hands in the air in an act of surrender and yelled, "Don't shoot," right before he was shot and killed. 1 week later, members of the St. Louis Rams, they came out of the tunnel during pregame introductions and gave the hands up, don't shoot sign, you know, hands over the head. This was becoming a gesture of protest against what critics were calling police brutality and a devaluing of black lives. It was actually out of these protests of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson that the Black Lives Matter movement began to pick up steam and gained international attention. That same year, 2014, police officers in New York City approached Eric Garner. They were questioning him about selling single cigarettes on the street. Eric Garner was unarmed, but police officers put him in a chokehold. And in videos that surfaced a few months later, Garner could be heard pleading with the officer, saying, "I can't breathe," as he lost consciousness. He was pronounced dead 1 hour later. In response, professional athletes like NBA stars Derrick Rose and LeBron James and Kyrie Irving, they wore T-shirts with Garner's last words, "I can't breathe," printed on them. The message being, all of this violence is suffocating. Now, the fact that LeBron James was involved in these moments, I think, is interesting. LeBron James was the consensus best player in the NBA in that decade. And I can't speak to the precise reasons for LeBron's activism, but I suspect it must partially be a reaction to what happened to him in the summer of 2010. That summer, LeBron James was the two-time reigning MVP of the league, but he was also a free agent. And there was feverish debate about where he would go. And most people assumed he was going to stay with the Cleveland Cavaliers, his hometown team, and a team that had drafted him straight out of high school. But in a televised ESPN special known as The Decision, LeBron announced that he was, quote, taking his talents to South Beach. He was leaving the Cavaliers, as was his contractual right, and he was going to the Miami Heat. And this decision provoked outrage and condemnation. In Cleveland, fans burned LeBron's jersey. This is more or less when that curious tradition started. The owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, Dan Gilbert, he called LeBron's decision, quote, a shameful display of selfishness and betrayal. He called it, quote, a shocking act of disloyalty. Now, let's be clear. Dan Gilbert cut players all the time. Dan Gilbert did not renew player contracts every year, as was his contractual right. That's the business of the NBA. But when LeBron did it to him, he was shockingly disloyal. There was a national argument about this. Jesse Jackson weighed in and said Dan Gilbert had a slaveholder's mentality. And we could talk all day about the optics of LeBron's decision. We could talk about the claims and the rhetoric of Jesse Jackson. But clearly the backlash to this decision affected LeBron James. You know, here he was, a young black man exercising his freedom, you know, taking control of his life and doing what he thought was best for him. And he was pilloried for doing so. People were outraged. And the harsh reaction to him exercising his free agency, I assume it made him more willing to speak up and be heard. So he donned the hoodie when Trayvon Martin was killed. He wore the I Can't Breathe shirt in remembrance of Eric Garner. And then the stories and the videos, they just kept coming. I mean, this was partly the result of the sudden proliferation of cell phones, which are portable recording devices, which we all have in our pockets. There was 12-year-old Tamir Rice shot and killed in Cleveland. Freddie Gray died in police custody in Baltimore. Keith Lamont Scott shot dead in Charlotte. Every month, seemingly a new incident, many of them captured on video. And I am not here today to adjudicate all of these moments, but they all ended with a black man or a kid who was dead, and usually a white police officer who was at the other end of the gun and not charged with a crime.
After the break, Colin Kaepernick takes a knee.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. See for yourself when you sign up today and get $150 in bonus bets when you bet just $5. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment, it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was booted!
Much of the joy you will find on the road comes from the person you share it with.
So you write the books, Gene, and Vlastar runs the business. I understand now. It's a wise man who marries a wiser woman.
But be careful and choose your travel partner well, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
Get down!
I'm not stupid, Gene. Something is going on, and it's high time you tell me the truth.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
So travel before it's too late. Your money will return, your time won't, and we're all too quickly approaching that final destination.
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death? This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tale.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
All 12 episodes of The Passage are available now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is when another athlete, the San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, got involved. And there is more to this story than most people seem to know. Beginning with the 49ers preseason games in 2016, Colin Kaepernick would remain seated on the bench during the national anthem. And his actions received very little attention at first, him just sitting there. But they did receive the attention of Nate Boyer. Boyer was a former Green Beret. He had served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and then he briefly played in the NFL. He was a long snapper for the Seattle Seahawks. And Nate Boyer wrote Colin Kaepernick a letter, and he defended Kaepernick's right to sit during the anthem. He acknowledged the persistent problem of race in the United States, but he also explained to Kaepernick why his sitting offended him as a veteran. And the two began a dialogue with each other. And Kaepernick explained to Boyer that his intention was not to offend veterans, but that he felt unable to stand and celebrate the words of the anthem when he felt Black Americans were not free. And Nate Boyer said he understood. And so he suggested to Kaepernick that he kneel during the anthem. He said kneeling is more appropriate. In most religions, kneeling is an act of humility. Kneeling is a way of humbling oneself before forces that are bigger than you are. And Kaepernick found this idea intriguing. This was one of the ideas he wanted to convey, that this was not about him. He was interacting with forces and issues much more important than football, so he kneeled. But kneeling was more obvious. Kneeling put him more out in the open, and so people noticed. I mean, boy, did they notice. Reporters surrounded his locker, and they asked Kaepernick, what does it mean? And Kaepernick was very clear. Here's what he said. I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color. To me, this is bigger than football, and it would be selfish on my part to look the other way. There are bodies in the street and people getting paid leave and getting away with murder. That's what he said. So this was a critique of racism and police brutality, murder as he saw it. And it was a statement that as a high-profile professional athlete, he had an obligation to use his fame to educate, to illuminate a problem. Agree with what he did, disagree, whatever, that's why he did it. And national opinion was exactly that. It was split. Some praised and thanked Kaepernick for his convictions, for risking his career to illuminate a problem like Ali had done with the Vietnam War in 1967. Others saw his gesture like many had seen what Smith and Carlos had done in 1968. They saw it as immature, offensive, ungrateful, unpatriotic. His jersey was burned even by 49ers fans. Taking a knee became shorthand for making a public statement that you were aligning yourselves with the Black Lives Matter movement. It is a statement that you believe that racial injustice and violence remains at an epidemic level. And a lot of athletes started doing it. Maybe I shouldn't say a lot, but some athletes started doing it. And it's the players in the WNBA, the Women's National Basketball Association, who were taking a knee in the largest numbers. Like NBA players, WNBA players, they had wore those shirts with social justice messages on them. But unlike NBA players, the players in the WNBA, they began locking arms and taking a knee to align themselves with Kaepernick's message, to challenge Americans to listen to the words of the national anthem and ask if Americans were living up to those ideals. You know, one WNBA player, Maya Moore, a superstar, she stepped away from basketball entirely to devote her life to the issue of misconduct by prosecutors. She raised awareness and raised funds for Jonathan Irons, a black man who had served 22 years in prison for a crime he likely did not commit. Key evidence that likely would have exonerated him had been withheld in his trial. Maya Moore walked away from professional basketball to fight for his release, and her efforts got Irons released from prison, and the two are actually now married. But whether it was wearing t-shirts with social justice messages, or taking a knee during the national anthem, or using Twitter to critique Donald Trump and his policies, you know, some Americans were getting very tired of athletes using sports to get their message across. In 2018, the Fox News host, Laura Ingraham, she told LeBron James to, quote, shut up and dribble. This was a sentiment that was forged out of the culture wars of our contemporary era. But it was also a sentiment that we saw way back with Muhammad Ali. Athletes are to be seen and not heard. You know, athletes are prized for their bodies and not their mouths. So just shut up and dribble. And then came the summer of 2020, which was the summer of COVID and so many other things. In May of 2020, the NBA and the WNBA, all professional sports, they were on hiatus due to COVID when the video of a white police officer killing George Floyd surfaced. And this came right after news of the killing of Breonna Taylor, Breonna Taylor was a medical worker who was shot and killed by Louisville police officers in March of 2020 during a botched raid on her apartment. NBA and WNBA players are members of the community, and they were not playing basketball at this time because of the pandemic. So many of them were part of the marches and the protests against these killings. They were among the voices insisting that Black Lives Matter and justice needed to be served in these cases. But then the NBA and the WNBA called their players back to work. They were called to Orlando, to Disney World, to play basketball in the so-called bubble, where they would be isolated. Kyrie Irving was an all-star guard and the vice president of the NBA Players Union, and he made the argument that playing in the bubble would be a distraction and a disservice to the mass movements in the streets following the death of George Floyd. He and some others made the argument that playing basketball would shift the focus from illuminating racism and police violence to who did what in last night's game. This argument did not carry the day. Players like LeBron James and the union president Chris Paul, they argued that they could do more to raise awareness about racial inequity if they were actually played basketball. You know, they could use their fame as players to illuminate these issues. And the NBA and the WNBA higher-ups, the league office and the team owners, they aligned themselves with the players here. They added the words Black Lives Matter to the court. They allowed players to choose from a prearranged selection of racial justice slogans. They could put these on their uniforms. They defended the players and coaches when they took a knee during the national anthem. This was a pretty radical moment in American sport history. Maybe it's meaningful. Maybe this is less meaningful than being in your community. I think it's an interesting and fair question. You know, I, for one, certainly wanted my basketball back. But the optics of it all happening in the fantasy land known as Disney World, it did seem a little bit like these men and women were packed away in a snow globe while the rest of the world raged around them. Well, the snow globe cracked and almost broke open entirely in August of 2020 when yet another video surfaced. Video of police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, shooting an unarmed Black man, Jacob Blake, in the back. Speaking about being in the bubble, George Hill of the Milwaukee Bucks said in frustration, "We shouldn't have even come to this damn place, to be honest." And that frustration led to the Milwaukee Bucks postponing a playoff game, going on strike for racial justice. And it led to a cascade of strikes across the sports landscape. The WNBA stopped. Major League Baseball stopped. The NHL playoffs and Major League Soccer took a pause. So many things happened so quickly. But I think 50 years from now, just as we look back over 50 years ago to the moment when Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists, I think we will look back to this moment in August of 2020 and say this was a moment when many things changed. Not everything, but many things. And here's why I think we will say this. The NBA and WNBA players refused to go back to work until their team owners pledged to open their arenas for voters in the upcoming presidential election. So this was concrete action. And more than this, and this may be the most symbolic and significant story of all, and I do not mean this in a partisan or personally political sense. I just mean that this moment literally changed the course of this nation. It changed American history. In a story that I think combines all of the themes we've been talking about today, the WNBA players went after one of their team owners. Kelly Loeffler was a Republican senator from Georgia, and she was also one of the owners of the WNBA's Atlanta Dream. And she openly criticized her league's decision to embrace and use the phrase Black Lives Matter. She called the Black Lives Matter movement anti-police, anti-church, anti-family, and anti-American. And instead of the phrase Black Lives Matter, she said the WNBA should put the American flag on its court and uniforms. And her players rebelled against her. They started campaigning for one of her potential opponents, Raphael Warnock, a Black minister from Atlanta. He was the minister at Ebenezer Baptist Church, the same church that Martin Luther King Jr. had been a minister. Polls said that Warnock was in fourth place in that Senate race. And then the WNBA players threw their support behind him. They ended up stumping for him. And Warnock ended up defeating Kelly Loeffler in that Senate race. And this was the race that flipped the Senate from Republican-controlled to Democrat-controlled. And again, I do not say this in a partisan sense. I say it as a historian of American sport. I do not think there has ever been a more obvious link between athlete activism and concrete, measurable political change in the history of the United States. That is the moment. So I want to build off all of this and wrap up our course. When Colin Kaepernick started taking a knee in NFL stadiums in 2016, there was a lot of outrage and many arguments offered against it. And I think we could have a dialogue about this. But there was one argument out there that I'd like to address. It came from the former NFL quarterback and CBS football analyst, Boomer Esiason, who said the following about Colin Kaepernick, quote, "I cannot say it in the strongest, most direct way that it's an embarrassment, and it's about as disrespectful as any athlete has ever been. And I don't care what the cause is. The NFL football field is not a place for someone to further their political ambitions," end quote. In other words, no matter the issue, no matter how right you may be or wrong, the football field, the sporting arena, is not the place for politics. Now, I'm tempted to say, okay, Boomer, but as a historian of American sports, this is an argument that I'd like to actually respond to. When Boomer Esiason says that the football field, the sports arena, is not a place for politics, he's just wrong. As we have discussed in this course, sporting spaces have been political from the start. They were spaces where the upper class broadcast their supposed superiority to the laboring classes. Sporting arenas were spaces to articulate ideas about whiteness and blackness and racial hierarchies and places to counter those ideas. They are spaces where we as a nation have debated feminism and gender equality. They are the spaces where the American ideals and the democratic system were trumpeted against Soviet communism. Football players and other athletes have been used to sell wars, like the war in Iraq, to the American people for decades. As an NFL veteran, Boomer Esiason was part of those very political displays. After September 11th, they were a rallying space for impending militarism. Never mind whether you were for or against the war, your sports were part of the government's foreign policy project. So look, you can agree or disagree with Colin Kaepernick's message. You can agree or disagree with his using the anthem for his protest. But if Boomer Esiason thinks that sporting arenas are not spaces for politics, he just is not paying attention. So I'd like to thank you for your attention and being willing to consider all of these issues with me. I am hopeful that you found our discussions interesting and enjoyable. And I am hopeful that you think about sports at least a little bit differently than when we began.
That's it. It's over. For Professor Matt Andrews, I'm Mike Coscarelli. Maybe you'll hear from us again sometime soon.
School of Humans.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, what's good?
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I am the ferryman.
In the shadows of the afterlife, the ferryman of souls guides America's most influential spirits to their eternal rest.
Where are you taking me?
Are you death?
This road is not on any map.
How much for a ticket?
All I ask for in payment is a tail.
I don't know who got to Kennedy first.
And the devastation those first bombs caused.
I've never been to hell, but I know intimately the hymns of the damned.
Binge this season of The Passage now. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.